Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Tim Smith, a member of the Club Science and Technology Member-Led Forum and your co-chair for this evening. We also welcome our listening audience and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealth.club.org. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished moderator for the evening, Evan Ackerman. Evan is a senior writer for Automation, which is IEEE Spectrum's award-winning robotics blog. To date, Evan has written over 3,000 articles about robotics, covering personal robotics, industrial robotics, and everything in between, including jellyfish robots. In 2007, he co-founded his own blog, Bot Junkie, and then joined IEEE when Bot Junkie was acquired in 2011. Evan is also currently the interim managing editor of sci-fi's device.com. So please join me in welcoming Evan Ackerman, and Evan will introduce the panel.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Tim. I'm very excited to be here and to be able to bring in these three amazing panelists who I will now introduce. Down at the end, we have Joe Augenbraun. Joe has founded six companies, including Nitto Robotics. Nitto sells a robotic vacuum that includes the most advanced intelligent mapping system available in a consumer robot using a rotating laser distance sensor and SLAM software technology like you'll find on Google's self-driving car. Joe holds over 25 U.S. patents covering topics such as information architecture, video and image processing, solar energy, and, of course, artificial intelligence and robotics. And next to Joe is Melanie Wise. As co-founder and CEO of Unbounded Robotics, Melanie makes next-generation robotics platforms for research, education, and developers. Before Unbounded, Melanie was manager of robot development at Willow Garage. She's been developing and designing robot hardware and software for more than 10 years, including an autonomous boat, an autonomous car, and battle bots. Melanie is also the co-creator of the TurtleBot, a low-cost personal robot kit with open-source software. And right next to me is Peter Abiel. And Peter is on the faculty at UC Berkeley in the Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Sciences. He has developed apprenticeship learning algorithms which have enabled advanced helicopter acrobatics, including maneuvers which only exceptional human pilots can perform. His group has also enabled the first end-to-end completion of reliably picking up a crumpled laundry article and folding it using a PR2 robot from Willow Garage. His current research focuses on robotics and machine learning with a particular focus on challenges in personal robotics, surgical robotics, and connectonomics. And to get started, I thought that we would just have each of our panelists tell us what their favorite fictional robot is, since this is a panel about kind of Rosie-inspired personal robotics. Why don't we start with that? And if you could also, as a part of that, maybe explain to the audience what the real robots are that you work with, that would be great too. So Joe, we'll start with you.
Okay, great. So I started building robots as a little kid for fun. I built a dog that would follow you, pull a leash, it would follow you and bark and wag its tail. Starting as a kid, I read science fiction, like I imagine a lot of people in the audience did. I was really struck by the iRobot series of stories, and particularly, I think it was the first story in the iRobot book, where the little kid had a robot who was actually his friend. The question of could a machine have that sort of human-like interaction, where it becomes part of your family and part of your life, just really struck me. And the robot that I represent here, the company that I founded, is Nitto Robotics, and I would say our robotic vacuum is hardly cuddly, but it's still lovable. People, we had someone who sadly their robot died, and they sent in an obituary, a 2-page obituary for the robot, and it brought tears to your eyes. I mean, we sent him a new one because the obituary was so good. But people do fall in love with robots of any sort, and what makes like Evan said, what makes our robot special is it actually knows where it is in the room, which is a great contrast to the iRobot robot, which just sort of bounces around at random. So it's really advanced technology that goes into this $400 consumer package. And being able to advance the state of the art, and in our case, work in, you know, any random home that you put it in is the real advance that we did. These really unstructured environments, I really enjoy that.
I guess for me, my favorite robot is significantly different. I think this is a generational thing, but my favorite robot is Johnny Five. There's nothing like a robot that can defeat our nation's enemies and then come home and cook breakfast for you and dance and serenade you over a nice Chianti or something like that. So I thought Johnny Five as a kid was really cool. It was fun. And he kind of got around some of the more traditional problems with robotics from my perspective now that I know more about robotics. Like, he doesn't have legs. He has tank tracks. You know, there is no bound with tank tracks, you know. And legs kind of deal with the challenges that we have because our environments are human-centric. And so that kind of, you can see some of that in the robot that we designed at our company at Unbounded Robotics. So we have a robot. That robot looks more like Rosie and less like, I guess, Johnny Five. It has a mobile base, so it looks like a really big Roomba on the bottom, and it has a laser in it. And then as you go up from there, you have like something that might be considered a torso. It has one arm and a head that can look around, pan and tilt. And it's orange and white, and it's very friendly looking, because one of the things that we tried to do was make the robot approachable, because people have a lot of expectations when it comes to robots, and we tried to kind of break down some of those barriers by making the robot look more approachable. So we put really big radiuses on everything. I think that we looked at the problem from that robot is, you know, there's lots of people with disabilities who don't need legs and who don't need a second arm. And so our robot can work in human environments and things like that without having to deal with those things. That's why there's elevators. You don't have to go upstairs if there's an elevator. But that's our robot. And but Johnny Five, you know, one of these days I hope that our robot will be able to make me fried eggs and some toast and serve me some orange juice in the morning.
So when you say that your robot is big, can you describe
it? Oh, yeah, sorry. The robot's about, it's in its compact position, it's about 3 feet tall. It weighs 160 pounds, but it has like an ET effect, so it can telescope its whole spine, so it can work on the ground or at a tabletop. And so it's kind of like a chunky teenager. Okay.
So okay, Peter.
Sure. So for me, I would say there was this TV show called Knight Rider, and there was this awesome car that could talk to you. You could talk to it through your watch, and then it would think about things for you. Sometimes it had seemingly internet access before the internet existed. You're able to look everything up about whoever you're chasing. So that was most intriguing to me, and the car could jump. Now, what I'm doing right now is what we mostly look at is really the software behind robots. So we're not working with a particular robot per se, though in practice we run experiments with specific robots, but the work we do is mostly about general approaches that might work for a variety of robots. And then the specific robots we tend to test with are what we call personal robots, which is robots that are supposed to do things in homes and offices. So one of them is a PR2, which was built by Willow Garage. Another one is the Baxter, built by Rethink Robotics. And then we also have some surgical robots. We have Da Vinci, which we can program, and we have a Raven, which we can program. But for all four of these, we didn't build the robots. We look at how to program them.
And most of these robots have arms, and they're big, and they're sort of human-sized almost?
Correct, yeah. So they're all somewhat human-sized, probably because that's the most likely way to perform manipulation tasks in human environment if you at least are the right size to do the tasks.
Okay. Well, before we talk about sort of the future of home robots, I'd like to establish where home robots are right now. So we have robot vacuums, and do we count sort of smart appliances as robots? Like what, Joe, you can start with this maybe. Like why do we have robot vacuums but no other robots in our homes, or do we have other robots in our homes?
I struggle with this question. I actually wonder if I could be so bold. If I ask the audience, is a standard dishwasher a robot? No, not a single hand. How about a washing machine? One hand. How about a washing machine? Is that a robot? A few hands. See, it's interesting because they've got a microprocessor. They manipulate things in the physical world, and they in the more advanced models, they can make a decision on what to do, whether to run a longer wash cycle or whatever. Yet somehow it's not emotionally a robot. So, you know, the question of whether, you know, what robots are in the home. Right now it is only robotic vacuums and maybe a few robotic mops, et cetera, Mint and Scuba. What was the question? It's the state of robotics in the home.
Yeah, and what is a robot in the home, really?
Yeah, what is a robot in the home? I think it's got to be something that you can form an emotional connection with. I think that, you know, we have a vision of what a robot is, and it has to meet that emotional connection for a robot. Yeah, I can't call a dishwasher a robot either, even though it's got all the elements a block diagram would say it should.
You guys agree?
I would tend to disagree because I think that it's a branding problem no matter what. I think that the minute it does something functional or useful, it suddenly gets a new name. Like the kiosks in airports, they're now today called kiosks, but they used to actually be called robotic ticketers. And your dishwasher actually used to be called a robotic washer for dishes. And so I think that a lot of it changes as technology evolves and as consumers' tastes evolve. And so I think it's very hard to try and put a pin in the board and say, like, that is exactly what a consumer robot's going to look like. But in general, you know, like, a great example is cars. We're moving more and more towards very sophisticated vehicles, vehicles that can park themselves, vehicles that can do adaptive cruise control so you don't have to change how you're following someone. But do you guys consider that a robot? Because you're slowly getting closer and closer to this robotic technology in your cars, but the car isn't changing in terms of the way you interact with it very strongly. You still get in it, you still drive to where you're going to go every morning, and they're not calling it a robot car. They're calling it driving assist. They're calling it parking assist, adaptive cruise control. They're not calling it robot, you know, cruise control. So I think that it's very hard to nail down what that actually is, but I would consider most things that have some automation in them to be robots.
Part of the question was also, what incarnation will the robots have in the future, right, in the home? And I think it could very well be a race between people building specialized machines and people building more general robots, because the whole kind of benefit of a general robot is that it can do so many things, but if everybody already in their home has a machine for every little thing that needs to happen, then it's going to be hard for there to be a market for the robots that can do everything, because everything's already being done. So it's going to be interesting to see, I guess, how quickly the machines for specific things get there versus still there being many tasks to be done for more open-ended robots.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'd all definitely like more robots that can do all of these things. So can you describe, I guess, from a research standpoint, what kinds of things are people working on in like a lab right now that we might be excited about in the next 5 or 10 years?
Well, I know some things people are working on. let's see. If we're kind of looking at what's happening in the labs, I think one thing that's really interesting to realize is that there's been a big shift in how robotics research is done in labs over the past 5 or 10 years. And that it used to be, if you wanted to work on robotics in a lab, you had to bolt together your robot in some way, maintain it. Probably a good chunk of your time you were maintaining your robot. Then you started from scratch programming it. It'd take a lot of time before you even got a robot to do something that other people already had done in other labs would take a really long time. Maybe you're 3 or 4 years into your PhD before you have a state-of-the-art robot in your lab, and then finally you can start thinking about what new contribution you're going to make, right? And so I think that has changed a lot with combination of the internet, and then so people have access to share code, you can use other people's code, and then in robotics, ROS, which is the robot operating system, which is this kind of open source repository of code from many research labs around the world that was started at its very beginning at Stanford, then it was quickly partnered with Willow Garage, and Willow Garage really took it kind of to heart to kind of motivate people to contribute to that one code base, allowing people to then leverage other people's work and really get up to speed much more quickly. And I would say another thing that Willow Garage did was put out the PR2 robot, which allowed you to unbox a robot that needs repair at most, in our lab's case, once a year. That's it. Whereas it used to be a very different kind of environment that you had to work in to get a robot to do something. Now it's, okay, once a year we call Willow Garage, they repair the robot, and that's it. So I think we can see people working on a lot more tasks now than we could 5 or even definitely 10 years ago. I think if we kind of look at what some of the labs are doing, a lot of what's going on, for example, in Osama Khatib's lab at Stanford is looking at how to deal with forces. So how do you have a robot that understands how much force it's applying and is kind of adaptive in terms of amounts of force that are being applied? Some of the labs, for example, at MIT, look at things like hierarchical planning, which is really important. How do you deal with really long horizons? You can't plan for a whole day of a robot at the level of just joint motions of the robot. But at the end of the day, that's all you need. All you need is joint motions of the robot to execute what you want to do. But it's just not the level at which you can plan. So you need to bridge the gap between high-level concepts and these low-level things that ultimately needs to be executed. And then, for example, some of the things we're working on in my lab is things like, how does a robot understand a deformable object, let's say a laundry article or tissue or suture, and how does it understand how to manipulate that? And a lot of what we look at is how to do that by watching humans do things. So watch a human do something, somehow build an abstraction from that, and then generalize to a new situation that is quite similar but not exactly the same, and see if it can still succeed in those situations.
So there's two things going on here. There's a lot of work being done in software, but then hardware is also a big component. And I know that the robot that you described that can fold laundry, the PR2, is $400,000. So Melanie helped develop that robot, but now your company has been able to make something similar for much less money. So kind of with an end goal of actually getting robots into our homes, like how do you go from something very expensive to cheaper to maybe the point where it's affordable?
Yeah, I think when you look at the PR2 system, which was started to be developed in around 2008, it was a big goal. It was trying to do something that no one had done to date, which was create a robotics hardware platform. There were lots of people making robots, but there were very few making platforms and making them available so that researchers could do interesting things. There's a lot of recycling that happened and reinventing the wheel that happened for very many years. But one of the biggest challenges with the PR2 is, at the end of the day, the price tag that got slapped on it was $400,000. And it was worth that. I mean, it was a very advanced system. It had two full servers in it, which had a total of 32 cores, I think 32 gigabytes of RAM. It had two full arms. It basically had a stereo depth sensor that was basically the Kinect, several years before the Kinect device ever was created. And it just had a lot of very interesting technology in it, but at the time it was very expensive to build. Also, when that project started, it wasn't sure where it was going. It was like, well, we're gonna do this beta program, we're gonna give robots to the community, and then we're gonna eventually iterate and make a cheaper robot.
Yeah, just to interject really quick, so Willow Garage made these robots, yes, and then just gave 11 of them away to research communities.
And so then eventually they decided to sell them, but the choices that were made in designing that robot, there were only 50 ever made, so it wasn't made for mass production. It wasn't made so that, you know, tomorrow we're going to roll out 10,000 PR2s, which is what you want to do in a consumer distribution of robots. And so when we started our company, we took a very serious eye towards manufacturability, high volume production, which in robots is still very small. If you look at, like, the world's yearly manufacturing of robotic arms, it's only 100,000 per year. So it's nowhere near the you know, millions of iPhones that are distributed every year. So in the robotics industry, 1,000 robotic arms is a big volume. You know, that's 1% of the total production for that year. And so when we looked at producing this robot, We looked at doing basically light industrial applications, stocking shelves, taking products off the shelves, and we looked at what the market would bear. And so the robot costs and business cost is about $35,000 for the base model and $50,000 for the pro model, which has some better processing power and a larger range laser. But when you look at what a boon that is to the research community, they're now going from a robot that costs $400,000 to a robot that costs $35,000. And many professors have told me that they're interested in, you know, several of our robots because the funding cycle is much easier for those robots. But I think that if you want to get to the home, a lot of people would say, well, what is the problem you're trying to solve? If you look at vacuum cleaning robots, it's pretty obvious. But, you know, where is the big thing that you're trying to solve? And a lot of people, when I was at Willow, the research came back, people want robots to do laundry and do their dishes, hands down. But the question we would ask back is, well, why doesn't Bosch or Samsung design a washer that does that? You know, because why do you want a robot to take your clothes from one container to another and move them 2 feet? And that's its whole job, you know. So I think that the question is, what do you want to solve? But I think that if you want to have a robot in your home, you have to get it cheaper. But that has to do with volume and different technologies and what the problem is.
And so, Joe, having gotten a robot into homes, kind of what did you have to do to make that happen? And not just any robot, but a robot that can operate reliably in all kinds of unstructured environments, and also one that has a fairly sophisticated sensor on it. Like, how did you get to the point where that was something that was not only commercially viable, but also useful to people?
It's interesting. I had flashbacks when Peter was talking about robotic researchers having to first put together the prototype robot. So we were doing something that required, at the time, fairly sophisticated robotics. And we started with a piece of plywood that we screwed motors and wheels onto, and we had to build a board that had drivers for the motors, and had a computer on it, and had we had to put a separate sensor that we bought to detect distance. Like, we had to put together, the first thing we had to do was put together a robot. It was crazy that we had to do that. Yet we did it, and we spent a lot of time fixing our stupid piece of plywood robot. It would break every 3 weeks. So we've actually lived that, and it cannot be underestimated how important it is that there are now off-the-shelf robots that researchers can use to develop the algorithms. The software is where it's at. In order to... Yeah. So I started Nito, wasn't called Nito at the time, but I started Nito while I was at Stanford University at the business school. So my background's engineering. I was going back to school for a business degree. And I wrote in my essay, one of my essays for entry into Stanford, you know, like, what are you going to do with this degree our fine institution is going to give you? I said, I'm going to start a robot company. That was one of my admissions essays, and they liked it. And so I said, oh my God, now I got to start a robot company. So during school, I went around and looked at all of the resources available to, you know, robot researchers, et cetera. And one of the people I met with was Sebastian Thrum, who's now at Google X working on the self-driving car. He's the one who did Stanley, the car that won the DARPA challenge. And I said, I want to build a robot that with a rotating laser distance sensor that sells for what a Roomba sells for. I'm going to, you know, sell it in volume to the home. And he'll argue that this happened, but this is my recollection of it. He said, get out of my office. That's stupid. You cannot build it for that kind of price. If you're lucky, maybe you'll get it down to $5,000. I said, no. I've built consumer products before. I'm going to sell this thing for several hundred dollars. And it was impossible. The cheapest laser distance sensor that was available at the time was $1,000, and it wasn't very good. The good one was $5,000. And so we set out to build this robot. We built the laser distance sensor. Our current cost on it's around $25, and we're working on bringing it down from there. It's these systems that these robots have are not inherently expensive. They're not inherently made of platinum or something. There's nothing, you know, you don't need natural diamonds as part of them. These are things that can be cost reduced in the same way as every other product you have. It's just that people haven't had the will to do it, and they haven't had the volume. So my firm belief is, as these guys develop these applications and these technologies, I mean, this is the same thing we did. We took the SLAM technology that was developed. SLAM is simultaneous localization and mapping, where a robot can look around its environment and while it's moving, update its map of what's going on around it. It's a very sophisticated concept, and it's one that didn't exist maybe 15 years ago, I'd say, something like that, that range. Yet we took it, and we were the first ones to really put it into a volume product in the home. In the same way, I'm dying to build a laundry folding robot. Now, I will give a word of caution about that. I didn't know that we wanted to do a home robot company. I know I wanted to do a robot company. And I collected a team together. We said, all right, what kind of robot are we going to build? And we got all excited about cleaning the windows of skyscrapers. And so I went to, there's a janitorial company that is a big national janitorial company. I found the guy who managed San Francisco. I said, you manage skyscrapers, right? He said, yes. I said, great. How much would you pay? How excited would you be to have a robot to clean the windows of your skyscrapers? And he said, not at all. I'm like, why? What's wrong? He said, the percentage of my budget that I spend cleaning windows of skyscrapers is like 0.01%. I'm like, okay, great. Where do you spend your money? He said, emptying trash cans. That's a much harder problem. I could build you a robot that cleans skyscraper windows. Emptying trash cans is hard. Doors are closed. People's offices are messy. The problems that people want to solve are highly unstructured problems, incredibly unstructured problems. And maybe this goes back to the first question, why only robotic vacuums? For all that it's an unstructured problem, it's one of the more structured, unstructured problems in the home. But that's what these guys are working on. They're working on taking the unstructured problem of having a pile of cloth, wet cloth, and being able to pick it up, find the corners, and fold it. That's fantastic.
So how do we do that? How do we get robots operating in unstructured environments like our homes? Like, over the next 5 or 10 years, what has to happen to make that work?
Well, I think a lot of people will have different answers for this. I think
you
can knock at every research lab's door and they'll be working on the thing that's going to make that happen. If I get to pick,
sure,
and I do pick what we do in my lab at Berkeley, I think the biggest factor is going to be learning from demonstrations. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because I think as storage and so forth becomes cheaper and cheaper, and it's easier and easier to store a lot of data, index into a lot of data, I think it's going to be possible to index in such large amounts of data that you can't see exactly the same scenario you're seeing right now, but you're able to see something similar enough where you've seen somebody do the right thing, and now you just have to find a way to somehow morph it over to your new situation and kind of morph over what, first the scene they're in, then the actions they took, then execute that morphed version in some way that still succeeds. Of course, that's the tricky part. You want to morph it in a way that still succeeds, but I think if we have enough coverage of the space, that there's a good chance that something like that could start doing really well, and it'd be easy to extend things. Because now you can, if a robot can't do something new, who knows, maybe there is some new toy that needs to be repaired in a particular way because kids always break it, who knows what it would be. Then the parent could just show, collect the data, and share with anybody else in the world how they repaired this little thing, and now that data could be used by any robot around the world to then index into and understand what to do in this particular scenario.
So is it unreasonable for us to expect 100% autonomy from home robots?
I would say so, yes. The main reason I would say so is because I don't think we should think of robots as things that live their own lives. So to say, when you build a robot, you build it to help us. And I think you need to define what it means to help you. So you need to define what is it that you're trying to achieve, right? Maybe a clean room is what you're trying to achieve, or maybe getting laundry done is what you're trying to achieve, and so forth. But the robot kind of always has to get your input on what it's trying to achieve. And so in that sense, when really new things come up, it'll kind of just be stuck and not be sure what it should be trying to achieve.
I would say that what problems do we need to solve? I guess the question is, what's the timeline look like? Because, I mean, say tomorrow, if you wanted to buy a robot, all the dishes in your house had to be bright orange. How would you feel about that?
It's worth it.
I mean, today, you know, when people want their Roombas to vacuum their house, what do? They kind of Roomba clean their house. Or Neato clean their house, either one.
You know? None of the Roomba clean their house.
people
Neato's
do all
a little more forgiving.
But people do all these funny things, like they pick up the rug, they tape the rug down, they tape the cords down, they move the cords. They do all these things to accommodate the technology in their home. And so my question would be, well, what level of accommodation are you willing to have in your home? You know, like, for example, right now when the Pier 2 in Peter's lab folds towels, it does it on a squishy green surface. So would you be willing to put a squishy green surface somewhere in your home, like in your laundry room, so that it could fold your laundry? And so where is the compromise you're willing to make? But I think one of the larger challenges, if you want truly autonomous robots, is how do we effectively describe our world to a robot? Because it's more than just I want the room to be clean. It's I want my house to be clean in this specific way. When I come home and I put keys on the table, I want the robot to know that the keys don't belong there. They belong over by the door. These are very subtle things, but they're things that actually are very important to us as individuals. And the robot doesn't care about that. But how do you like teaching by demonstration is a very good way to teach a robot how to do that. It's like, well, robot, they don't belong here. They belong here, and you show it how to do that. But that's my home, and that could be different in Peter's home or Evan's home. And so I think that there's a lot of uniqueness challenges, and how do we effectively describe that? And then how do you store that information in a database? Who will come up with the idea that there's a link between these two things? Keys belong here, but if they're any place else, they belong there. You know, or that you have to do a required action. And so I think the biggest challenge in robotics in general is how do you effectively describe the relationships of environments in our objects in our environment and where they belong and how they should be treated. We develop these kind of natural ways of talking about things, but they're actually very complex. They're not things that you can just make singly linked lists to and be like, well, obviously, or have a very hierarchical state machine. They're actually very complex in the decisions that we make around certain things. But I think that if everyone in this room is willing to wear a green T-shirt, you know, for the next 10 years, then maybe we could solve the laundry problem. I think that there's concessions you can make, right? Like you can say all the cups are going to be orange, and now when you see orange objects, it has to be a cup. And if it's your cat, well, we're in trouble. But those are these compromises you can make, and you have to think about those as well, because it just depends on how fast you want to solve the problem and what compromises you're willing to make to get there.
The question of whether we could ever expect a fully autonomous robot. The thesis of that paper that I wrote for the admissions into Stanford was that the investment that we made in chips, I went around my house and counted up the number of microprocessors in my house. There was something like 39 microprocessors, every remote control and the thermostat and all of that. And the reason that we're able to do that is because, you know, we have Moore's law, twice the number of, you know, twice the density of transistors ever so many years, and things get cheaper and cheaper. And the basic value of a function on electronics is very low, on just pure processing is very low. But the fact that we can do it so well and so cheaply makes them ubiquitous. If we put the same kind of investment into doing physical actions that we've put into just making, adding two numbers faster and faster and cheaper, we would find that we could do these physical actions, and first there would be embedded applications, and then there would be more and more sophisticated applications. And I believe that we would have been there already if we had been making this investment all along. We're not trying to violate the laws of physics. In fact, semiconductor is more or less violating the laws of physics as was known 20 years ago. I mean, it's really astonishing what semiconductors have done. But in the robotics field, it's just that we're at the beginning of it. It's just that we haven't put the effort and the research into it. So I think this is one of these things, for any kind of development process for a new product, it's foggy where that product could be someday. But you can see what the next generation is. And once you get to that next generation, you can see the generation beyond that. And it all becomes clear a generation at a time. Right now, we can see our way to pretty slow and clunky researchery kind of laundry folding. That's a hop, skip, and a jump. I mean, that's 98% of the way there to practical consumer laundry folding. I mean, the hard part's now done. The fact that it needs to be a squishy green background, you're going to have a student who's going to fix that pretty quick. So I have a lot of confidence that we're going to get there to the devices that do what we want. And damn it, it will put away your keys in the wrong place or leave them in the wrong place, just like if you hired a person to straighten up your house, and you're going to tell it, no, I want my keys here. And next time it'll get it right, I think.
Well, I appreciate your optimism. And in our last few minutes, I just want to try and pin each one of you down. Like, what do you think in the next 5 to 10 years, if you can be as optimistic as possible or as realistic as possible, what are our home robots going to look like? Who wants to start?
I'm not ready to start.
Yeah, I can start. So I live in a house that was built in 1934, and one of the bathrooms is original. And the toilet and the sink that's there are completely, utterly compatible with a toilet and sink you can go buy at Home Depot today. The physical infrastructure that we live in gets very baked into our lives. You know, this house that was built in 1934, unless a really big earthquake comes or something else bad happens, it's going to be there in 100, still going to be there in 100 years. Robots are going to fit in to our lives in the way that things fit now. So the idea that there will be a robotic laundry center that physically takes the space of your current washer and dryer makes a lot of sense to me, because everyone has a space for that thing to live. Now, you know, is it going to come out of its niche? You know, is it going to have a flying drone component that goes around to your room where you have a designated corner where you can throw the laundry and no one really bothers you about it because it gets instantly picked up, you know, the next morning? You know, are you going to change your lives in those small ways? If your wife allows you. But these things are going to look more or less, I think, the way they fit into our lives is the same way that things fit into our lives today, because our infrastructure is so baked in. I've talked a long time. I've had a lot of ideas for different robots I want to build someday. Like, I'd like a box that's about the same size and shape as a microwave that you stick a tomato or a cucumber in, and it'll slice, you know, you go beep, 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 and it'll slice it or dice it however you want to. Totally easy. Very simple device. Doesn't exist. It will have it. It's, you know, I think we're going to find these things coming up from the bottom in these sort of embedded devices, and coming down from the top with UBR1s at $35,000, and maybe 10 years from now it'll be $5,000, and wealthy people will have it, and there will be 5 or 10 really neat applications that it works on. In the meanwhile, my slicing, dicing microwave oven cabinet has also been able to cook it and break the egg over it. And, you know, Johnny Five isn't delivering the omelet, but he cooked it for you. But you're going to have the UBR1, which will deliver it to you also. So I think we're going to see all of the above is really what's going to happen. It's going to come in from both ends simultaneously. Same way computers have. You know, you have a smartphone, but, you know, you also have embedded devices. This watch has an altimeter in it. It's got a microprocessor. It's got all of this functionality, but it's not a smartphone. It's just got some dumb functions, but it's still microprocessor based.
Melanie,
I think that I agree with some of Joe's sentiment that it will come from both ends. I think that you'll see a lot of progress in small devices that people bring into their homes, largely because of a cost point, not because of other reasons. I think it's really a value proposition when you start asking people, you know, to buy something that costs as much as a car or a dishwasher or a washing machine. You know, being married, you know, that's a big decision to make in your home. You know, like, are we going to buy this brand new washing machine? Doesn't the other one just work just as well? You know, what's the motivation for that? And I think that you have to talk about the value proposition it provides. You know, like, if you say today, well, you can You can have a car or you can have a $35,000 robot. Everyone's going to ask, well, what is that robot doing for me? You know, what is so great about it? And so I think that you could have robots like UBR1 in your home. It's designed to be compatible with ADA compliant homes, which is a lot of modern construction, basically everything after like 1980. But there's some challenges because what does that robot do? And that's some of the hope that we have with UBR1 is that we can build more of them, more people will use them. We might actually get app developers programming them, which is really important if you want to see progression in the software applications. But I think that value proposition is the biggest challenge. And there's lots of big companies who make their business around applications and appliances. You have to, they may have a better way of doing it. You know, robots may not be the ideal solution for some of these problems. I know we all love robots. I love robots. I wouldn't, work on anything else, but maybe a dishwasher is the right way to do it. You know, sticking a robot's arm into a sink and picking a dish up and rubbing a cloth on it, I'm guessing is not the most efficient way to solve the problem. And so I think that's the other thing, is we have to be smart about how we make these decisions and why we're doing it. You know, is it because we love robots, or is it because it's actually solving a need that we have, and whether they're the right way to solve that need? I would love for UBR1 to do my laundry and dishes and all the other things that I really wish my husband would do, but but I do anyway. So I think that's interesting, but I don't know. I think it will come from both ends, but I think it also depends on how much concession you're willing to make. I would put orange dishes in my house if it meant the robot would always take them out of the dishwasher and put them in the cabinets. And I would probably wear all green T-shirts if it would do the laundry, but don't quote me on that one.
I like orange.
And Peter.
So I think I agree largely with kind of what Melanie was expressing, which is it depends a lot on the compromises we're willing to make. Like, are you willing to have things tagged, have certain things labeled and so forth, so it's easy for a robot to understand where things are, what they are, and so forth. It's hard to predict what people are willing to do going forward. I would say another thing why I think we're still, like, if you look at other, let's say the software industry in general, like, what happened is with the internet and with app stores and things like that, there was just a big push. Now, all of a sudden, everybody could make money. Not everybody ends up making money, but everybody feels like they could make money by writing an app, right? And there is not that kind of push and momentum. We're not there yet in robotics where any kid could say, yeah, I'm going to spend the weekend programming something for a robot, and if I'm lucky, I'm going to make $1 million. It's not there, and I think it also means that there is not as much effort invested yet. Like Joe was saying earlier, it's just all the research and effort hasn't been done yet, and so it might still be pretty far away, but there might be a point where, I guess, when people think with a couple of days of programming they might hit the jackpot, that's when maybe a lot of people will start putting in more effort and we can kind of really accelerate the progress, and things might happen more quickly than we think at that point.
Okay, I think we've got 10 or 15 minutes for questions, if anyone wants to step up to the mic there.
Yeah. Before that, I'd just like to thank the panel for their comments here today and to remind our listening audience that this program is the Commonwealth Club of California. You are listening to Where is Rosie? The State of Personal Robotics. We now open the floor to Q&A. Please keep your questions short and to the point, and also be sure that your questions are, in fact, questions.
I've got one. Industrial robots have been around for 35 years in the factories, and all the consumer robotic companies seem to have no ties to this history. And I was wondering why there doesn't seem to be a matchup there between what's been out there operating for 20 years and what everyone is thinking of now.
I guess I could start with that one. I think that there's some things that are, if you look at the evolution of robotics, say, the first robot arm that was deployed was a Unimate. It was deployed in a GE factory. It moved very hot things from one place to another. It actually didn't have a computer. Everything was encoded on magnetic disks, and there's a lot of legacy in that industry. And so some of the things that come from why there isn't much of a bridge is legacy. A lot of the technology is running on programmable logic controllers, things like that. There's a lot of big differences between automation equipment and what you might call a consumer product. Also, the regulations are very significantly different. The thing that you're going to put in a factory has other safety regulations associated with it. And then the next thing is a lot of those things aren't mobile, and a lot of things that people are looking at in the consumer space are, and very few of them have arms. So I think it's a very large mix of things, and when you're doing industrial automation and robotic arms, if you become very good at that, there's not a lot of motivation to branch out into the consumer space either. That would be my, how I would assert it, but I could be wrong.
Hi, I'm Brent, a recovering electrical engineer, hardware. Elon Musk, I appreciate the fact that you can integrate hardware and software with everything. But some of the issues you brought up, like washing dishes, what's not to say that you're not going to have a 3D printer to print your dishes, that you don't need a robot to do it for you? And in addition to that, are you being a little naive about the fact that you're talking about an open software system, right? What's not to keep Rosie from coming after you with a knife at some point?
So certainly there are virus writers who would really appreciate the ability of Rosie to go after you with a knife. I think this question, so first of all, I think 3D printing is fascinating. And you can imagine a future where the value of a house you buy is in the land, because you can just 3D print the new house to go there, right? You can imagine, there's actually a group who's doing foam house size 3D printing. It's really fascinating stuff. So the idea that maybe dishes don't exist in our future world is entirely possible. But we have a 4-year-old, and I assure you there will always be a need for ongoing maintenance of some sort in the home. And it may not be dishes. But in terms of safety, the question of safety, I think this is one of the big research topics that people are taking on. I have an interest someday in building an exercise robot where instead of standing on a treadmill, it's got robotic arms that you're standing on and robotic arms that you're holding on to, and maybe you're wearing a VR helmet, and whatever motion you're doing, you can pretend it's a bicycle, it can pretend it's a treadmill, it can pretend it's an elliptical, whatever, and you feel like you're in the environment. I have an interest in doing that. I've been asked the question, how are we going to be sure it's not going to kill you? That does seem a sticky wicket. But there are people doing wonderful work on human-robot interaction and keeping it safe. And I think that's one of the important open questions that exist today.
And I think on the safety aspect, I think that there's a long history in other technologies where safety and security have been vetted, and you can bring over a lot of those things, like from the software aspects. You know, we all have computers. We all have security for those computers. Well, most of us do. Since robotics is like kind of this combined notion of hardware and software, I think that there are pre-existing ways of dealing with this. You know, planes don't fall out of the sky today because there's regulations and safety and checks and redundancy to prevent fly-by-wire. I mean, some planes do not have a physical connection between the thing that you steer with and the ailerons in the plane. And that's significant. I mean, that was a big step for aviation. And so I think that there will be ways to deal with safety and security and preventing our robot overlords from, taking us over one day. But
I want to get on the record that I, for one, welcome our robot overlords. There you
go. Peter, for the college kids to be able to go wild and the burners to be able to go wild, like blisters in the sun making your apps, what hardware and infrastructure needs to be created, or what kind of stuff does he need to make cheap for you, for the people to be able to do all sorts of things and the robots to be able to take off?
Well, I think if you really want to sell an app, right, let's say
you today wrote an app that can perfectly clean your dinner table and load the dishwasher and put everything away, right? If you wrote that, then still it'd only be used initially in a few research labs that have the same robot that you had, right? And so you somehow need the presence somehow of these robots in more places at an affordable price. So now if everybody has a robot and it couldn't yet do that, and you write that program and they say, well, for $100 we never have to clean off the table anymore, you might sell a lot of that app to a lot of people, right? But somehow I guess there's this initial stage that you need to get through where maybe there is something the robot can already do that already makes it valuable to people, so they already buy it. Maybe they buy a robot that can do laundry. They want to pay something for that, and now somebody else sells the dinner table cleaning app, and then the people are willing to pay for that. Maybe somebody else sells then yet something else and so forth. It could be different tweaks, different new skills and so forth that come out over time. But I would say the reason it works so well to ride, well, the reason it's such a great lottery to play, so to say, to ride an iPhone app is that a lot of people have an iPhone. So if you happen to ride something that catches on, all of a sudden a lot of people might end up getting it, and they don't need to still go buy the iPhone. They already have it because they already had it for other reasons. Price tag-wise, I think right now it probably has to be quite cheap, or you need to give really good capabilities. It's hard to convince people to get a robot just because it's a robot, right? So it's kind of what value are you giving thanks to that robot, right? If it's $200, sure, maybe people will buy it no matter what, even if it can't do anything. But once you go above that, then you really need to provide something.
How do you get a student to think outside of their body? You're talking robots, arms, that's us. Legs, that's us. How do you get the student to think outside of the human body to create a robot like somebody thought outside of the telephone to create a mobile phone? How do you do that? How do you get somebody to think outside of the box of our body to create a robot?
I can say something here.
Yeah.
So I think for one, like, you'll always see this. If you work with people, some people are just very creative, some people are not as creative, and to some extent you need to be lucky to have some creative people working with you who just kind of naturally think about problems differently and come up with new types of solutions. One thing I would want to say though, to that effect, and also related to some other questions that came up, was the form factor of a robot going to be and so forth. I mean, a lot of the techniques that are underneath, right, if you say we want to build a robot that goes into the home, right, a lot of the things you have to think about are not that specific to the form factor of the robot. A lot of the things are about, can you build a system that understands what configuration this house is in right now? It understands that it's looking at a plate. It understands that it's looking at a cup. It understands that somebody wants something in a particular way and so forth. So a lot of it is largely independent of the form factor of the robot, but it's just understanding what's around it, understanding what ideally would happen to what's around it. Then, of course, the robot needs a form factor to make something move. But again, if you look at programs that make a robot move, you can actually often, you download a piece of code, and then a separate file describes the form factor of the robot. It'll say, this robot has these joints, these links, and so forth, and you then just provide us an input together with the program that motion plans to the robot, and it just works. So you actually don't write motion planning code that's specific to your robot. It just works as long as you specify what your robot form factor is. And so some people have started looking at things like, can you put designs of robots in the loop there, right? It's a little futuristic at times, but they might have something that plans, like says, if I change the shape of the robot and have this class of motion planning problems, how many of them can I solve with this shape of robot versus that shape of robot? And then they might do some kind of natural selection kind of stuff. It's done more with walking robots where they see, like, if I have a shape that changes, does it walk more naturally and so forth? But there is some work in that direction.
I have a different box in mind. Watching the video earlier of your vacuum robot, I'm thinking of a much bigger one that has a special application. I refer to this being the third anniversary of the Fukushima reactors. And so much of what you're describing actually is what we just need, some $100,000 and $1 million robots that basically do what you're talking about to do a lot of the cleanup that's going to be, that needs to be happening over the next decade. Perhaps you care to comment on that or not.
Well, that disaster was somewhat of a wake-up call for the robotics, I guess, industry in some sense, specifically in Japan. And there's been more of a concerted effort to try and look at how robots can handle those disasters. That's why the DARPA Robotics Challenge was convened, was to look at how robots can handle disaster situations and be agents for people in those situations. I think that in general, it's another specific line of research and I guess investigation, because there's the problems to that disaster is specific to that set of problems, you know, buildings falling down, dangerous environments. But that's always been a long-standing area of robotics research. I mean, there's the three Ds of robotics, and some would say there's four, but there's dirty, dull, dangerous, and then distracting or entertaining. People would call that the fourth D. But in those areas, people have been doing research for a long time, and actually the United States is pretty good at doing disaster robots, based on how we use them in the military and for search and rescue and things like that. And that's one of the things that really shone about the United States robotics program during that disaster, was that we were able to go in and supply robots to help with that situation. But I think people have become more aware of it because it was such a large disaster and it had such big impact around the world.
One interesting thing about that scenario is also that teleoperation is perfectly acceptable, right? Because you avoid sending a person in. If you can teleoperate a robot, even if you're busy for the entire stretch that the robot is doing things, at home you wouldn't want to teleop a robot as long as it takes yourself to do laundry. But for a scenario like that, you can avoid radiation. You're happy to teleop the robot potentially two or three times longer than it take you to be in there. So, yeah, I think there's been, I guess, in that sense, a little more attention maybe paid to kind of effective teleop of robots for these kind of things.
We'll take two more questions. So two of you.
Okay. So a lot of the conversation so far has been kind of on the hardware side. And in terms of the software side, you know, a lot of people, when they think of robots, they think of artificial intelligence. And it doesn't seem like artificial intelligence has moved an inch in 30 years. Maybe it has, but what's the state of the software and all the way up to artificial intelligence?
AI is a rebranding problem as well. Anytime anything gets smart or has nascent intelligence or it does any kind of learning, they relabel it as something else. So yeah, it looks like AI hasn't moved in 30 years, but there's been advancement. I mean, if you look at what's happened in the software side of robotics, so in 2007, when Willow-Grotch started, they started working on, as Peter mentioned, ROS, the robot operating system. I actually was a core developer on that software architecture and system for about 5 years. And it caused huge amounts of change in the robotics industry, from my perspective, and I would say from many other people's perspectives. One, it caused collaboration at a level that really hadn't been happening. Suddenly, someone from Peter's lab, someone from Willow Garage, and someone from maybe another research lab, Intel's research lab or MIT, could suddenly collaborate very easily on software. They could write parts of software that were interoperable with other parts of software, because that software architecture defined a message system that provided specific tools relevant to roboticists. So they created abstractions for geometric concepts like the 6D pose in space. They created logging methods that were relevant to robotics. They created transformation libraries. How do robots know where their body parts are? That's actually kind of a thing that people spend a lot of time reinventing. And suddenly there was, in some sense, a definitive library for doing that. And so you suddenly saw a transition of people no longer writing those pieces of software and doing other things. And it enabled people to leverage off-the-shelf hardware much more quickly. One of the things that when we did a poll of all the ROS users across the world, and there's a lot of ROS users, and it happened very quickly. When we asked them, you know, what are the things that they really use ROS for, originally it was like drivers, documentation and tutorials, and just the message passing architecture itself. And that was a survey that we did a while ago, but that was something that became very obvious, is that suddenly there was this huge collaboration and people were doing a lot more things together and getting past the how do we make this robot move and getting into how do we make it do something relevant. And so you saw between 2010 and now a lot of more large demonstrations with robotic systems. At TUM in Germany, they were making pancakes. In Bosch's lab, they were screwing things together with drills and getting beverages out of fridges, and had multiple robots collaborating. In Peter's lab, we saw people doing towel folding. And it's hard to quantify, like, you know, how much momentum that's created, but it, from a roboticist perspective, it created this huge momentum. All of a sudden, it felt like, wow, we're going someplace, you know? And that's really hard to quantify, but it's moved significantly. Maybe, Peter, you have other thoughts?
Well, in the software sense, things have changed a lot, as Melanie described. I think also if you think of kind of more broadly artificial intelligence as a field, there's been a lot of progress in the last 10, 20 years. Mm-hmm. And if you kind of see what's been happening is people have moved onto probabilistic methods, giving them a formalism to deal with uncertainty. They're using many places in AI, but for example, in robotics, they come up in mapping and localization. How do you localize a robot? You start with a distribution of where the robot might be. How do you manage to represent the distribution? Because it could be in so many locations. How to effectively compute with such a distribution that's difficult to manage in principle. So there's a lot of ideas that have come forward how to deal with probability distributions that involve lots and lots of random variables that can all take on many, many values. So this management of uncertainty, has been a lot of progress in that. Another area that's seen a lot of progress is machine learning, where you look at how do you learn from examples. Let's say you write a check, right, and you submit it to the bank, then that gets scanned, and some system automatically recognizes the amount you've written on the check. That's done through machine learning. That somebody build a system that can learn, that sees many, many examples of digits, and they're annotated with what digit they are, together with the image in which the digit is, and then the system learns what a digit looks like, and then when it sees a new set of handwritten digits, it recognizes that and so forth. And there's also progress in recognizing more things than just handwriting. But let's say you recognize maybe cars, pedestrians, and so forth. So I think there's been a lot of progress, but still a long way to go. Same time, if you think about the number of computational cycles we have in our brain, it's still much, much larger than we have in computers. So there's not just algorithmically quite a way to go, but probably also hardware-wise, we just don't have the same cycles yet.
I have something very brief that I want to add to that. I know it's been a long answer to that question. I think until these things touch our lives, it doesn't look like progress is made. And we are on the cusp of these things being able to touch our lives. You know, our little robot that knows where it is in the room, that's a very sophisticated bit of artificial intelligence, but it's not sexy enough that you're like going, oh my God, my life is so different because Neato Robot exists. But, you know, we are really on the cusp of these things becoming ubiquitous in the way that smartphones are. And that's all I'll say.
We've taken quite some time to get to this point, so I will try to phrase my question shortly. Following on what Mr. Augenbraun just said, where are we likely to see all of these robotic developments penetrate first? Are we really going to see it in the home, or is it more likely that someone like, say, a janitorial firm that has massive labor costs and is more interested in replacing that with a one-time capital cost will be the first adopters of more autonomous robotics, and we'll actually see that then grow into the home instead of starting in the home?
Amazon's already using robots in their warehouses, so you know that it's an easy answer. And hospitals have automated hospital carts. There's a lot of applications that already exist and already in the field in the commercial space. So yes, it'll be the commercial space, but
you know, there's something magical that happens. I remember my physician used something that looked an awful lot like an iPad 5 or 10 years before the iPad came out. And, you know, oh, that's neat. You know, it was a tablet computer. It was a tablet PC, and they had some kind of software that ran it. But until the iPad came out, like you didn't get it. Like, you know, you look at that thing, it's like, oh, that's interesting. You know, and, you know, the iPad all of a sudden, like, oh, my God, you know, this changes things that you can do. These robotic applications are going to be like that turbocharged 10x, and that's really when we're going to see the acceleration, is when it touches a lot of people's lives.
I also think that some of the advancement you might see is in our cell phones. And if you want to talk about not physical robots, but the software that comes from robotic algorithms, you know, there's a lot of work that we could do there. And like Peter said, you know, even the identifying the check auto deposit, like that's something that's like a glimpse of the way, you know, we use robotic technology. You know, maybe, you know, Google just announced their Project Tango, where you can take a cell phone and map a building. Well, that's, many people would say, robotic type technology. And robots could use that information in the future. I mean, some people would maybe even argue you could integrate that cell phone into your robot. So I think that cell phones are another thing, because they're so ubiquitous. Everyone has one. You can't stop people from touching them and have a conversation with them these days. I mean, we've become very cell phone centric, and I think that that may be another avenue for testing technology and maybe making bridge applications into robotic technology.
Well, thanks to the panel for their comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to this recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 111th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.